This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts, we're known for many things. Sports, a revolution, great seafood, tech, hospitals. A growing group of people want to add something else to that list. Health equity. And there's a new bill introduced this session on Beacon Hill that's looking to improve many things, including how the state tracks health equity in order to help find solutions and increase it. Here to talk about more about the bill, about the state of health equity in the Commonwealth, we'll start with Jeffrey Sanchez, co-founder of the Health Equity Compact, former state representative for the 15th Suffolk District, and a current professor of health policy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Jeff, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana, and thank you, Radio Boston.
Great to have you here. There's a lot to break down. We'll do the legislation itself in a little bit. I want to start with sort of the state of things first. Last year, Michael Curry of the Massachusetts Legal Community Health Centers and Juan Lopera of Beth Israel Lahey Health announced the Health Equity Compact here on Radio Boston. It's a big concept, health equity. When you think about it, what does it mean to you?
Well, for me, it's as practical as can be. It's ultimately how are Black and Hispanics seen and treated within the healthcare system, and especially in Massachusetts, where we have had incredible success in ensuring that pretty much 98% of the population and have kept that, and the commitment that exists to be able to maintain such a strong healthcare system. There are inequities, and the inequities are longstanding. And I think, and we all believe that the murder of George Floyd and the pandemic, they bought into even more into the mainstream the inequities that exist and the cracks that exist within the healthcare and the public health system.
So I'm intrigued by the treatment piece, Jeff, because I'm anticipating that we're talking about both treatment and outcomes. And I wonder, can you kind of conceptualize both for us? So give us an example of what it means to be treated equally by the healthcare system and an outcome that would be more equal if treatment were equal. Do you see what I mean?
It's incredible. We do live in Massachusetts. We live in a bubble. We have the greatest healthcare institutions on the planet, bar none. And this is me with my Massachusetts cheerleader hat on. At the same time, we do know at a very granular level that there are real problems on how people are treated to the point that we know that if we don't do something now, we either pay now or pay greater later, and we have responsibility to it. And we know that people of color, Hispanic folks and Black people as well, are probably more likely than others, than white people, to be uninsured at any point in their life here in Massachusetts. And also, we know that there's a significant number of people that have unmet healthcare needs due to costs and other things, and that we see that those statistics even more exacerbated in who it is. One in three Hispanics, 32.5%, over a quarter of Black residents, report unmet healthcare needs due to cost versus 22% for the white population. So there's certain pieces in this that go exactly to that on unmet need, and also to the structures that exist within our system to make sure that equity is a part of a norm to be able to redefine healthcare in the new century that we're in.
So, for example, one of the treatment differentials would be affordability, access. How easy is it to get to a doctor? How easy is it to afford healthcare?
And even in the treatment, we work with folks like the Massachusetts Sickle Cell Association that reports incredible high. They report incredibly high incidence of people who suffer from sickle cell that are disproportionately treated at emergency rooms. And if you know anything about sickle cell anemia and how it affects you, it's essentially your body's fighting against itself. And so there's an incredible amount of pain. So a lot of folks that have this disease go to the emergency room, and a high concentration of the folks that have sickle cell disease are African Americans, and they all report excessive discrimination within the emergency rooms when they they come in, when they do come in, to the point that they're treated as if they have substance use issues and not the underlying issue of sickle cell disease. And that's only one example. If you look at the Institutes of Medicine report that was done years ago, it talked directly about how Black men and how Black people are treated in the everything from the treatment room to the emergency room. And it's pretty jarring, those individual studies in that they point out so many glaring differences in how people of color are treated within the healthcare system. So it's a lot. The bill itself, it's a big leap so that we can try and get people together on this. This is about everybody who's providing care and everyone who's involved in the financing and oversight of it as well, because we want to make sure that here in Massachusetts that we have the strongest healthcare system in the world. We're very lucky with what we have, but we have to make sure that it works better for everyone.
We are talking about a new bill in the legislature on health equity as proposed by the Health Equity Compact. Still with us, Jeffrey Sanchez, co-founder of the Health Equity Compact and a former state rep for the 15th Suffolk District, now on faculty at the T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Also joining us now, Massachusetts State Representative Bub Williams, who represents the state's 11th Hampden District. Jeffrey Sanchez, thanks for staying with us. Rep Williams, welcome. Great to have you here. The Compact has introduced this legislation. It asks for things like creating cabinet-level executive office of equity, investing in community-led efforts already underway that are addressing root causes. There's a big piece about data collection. What are you hearing from other members of the legislature?
Well, first of all, thank you for doing this, and I want to thank Chairman Sanchez for really leading the charge in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I'm hearing great things. We had started with like 55 members of the equity, and I think it's a little more than that. And certainly, timing is everything. And what I'd like to start out, it's House Bill 2257, if anybody wants to take a look at it. And I go back with, there's a book, it's called Medical Apartheid, as written by Harriet Washington. And she explores a deep, dark history of medical experimentation with Black Americans and brown people. And what I'm simply saying is that there's so much mistrust with Black and brown communities with the health initiatives in Massachusetts in general and Springfield, Mass. In particular. And what happened is I always reference, this is something that people always reference, to a Tuskegee study, which talks about when the health medical people were telling the Black community that they were going to go in and they're going to help cure syphilis. And they were they had drugs and medication to cure syphilis. But what ended up happening is that they shot Black people up with syphilis. That has followed us for years as a cultural piece. So there's a real deep mistrust. But what this compact does, we absolutely want to have an executive office of equity, which will be a new cabinet position, which is great. And you're dealing with all kinds of issues, telehealth, equal access to health care, cost of insulin, high copays. There's so many inequities. And certainly, bill's been filed. I'm very happy to report that it's been assigned already to healthcare finance, which is a tremendous step for us in the coalition, because I thought it would probably go to public health, but it didn't. It went straight, because most how the House works, most stuff goes to different committees and ends up going to healthcare, and they end up vetting it. This went straight to healthcare.
So let me ask you, in that vetting, what do you think, Representative Williams, will be sort of the most important pressure points in getting it through?
We call it a call to action. That's all healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, healthcare folks, average citizens, to finally, take a step to bring Massachusetts the real health reform that it really, really needs. Because historically, we have been left out, black and brown people, historically. So my point, as I said, it started out with 55 members. We're probably well over that, Jeff, now, because every day I'm getting phone calls from some black nurses group, some Hispanic nurses group, doctors, healthcare providers who really want to make a difference. And timing is perfect. And if COVID really showed us, the emperor has no clothes. It exposed the real inequalities, which we already knew existed, in healthcare maintenance.
So let me jump in there. I'll turn back to you. You mentioned Jeff Sanchez again, who's still on the line with us. Jeff, I'll turn back to you. We are in a then and now moment, as Bud Williams just noted. You served in the legislature pre-COVID, pre-George Floyd. Do you think there's a kind of traction in the legislature now to push this forward that maybe there wasn't when you were serving?
Well, I believe that equity is in our blood in Massachusetts. It's just the roads that we take to get there. Like I mentioned before, Chapter 58 was a major step, and the legislature has made it a priority to make sure that that our universal coverage law is fully implemented at all times, despite whatever comes our way. And that's a pretty big deal.
And Chapter 58 being universal coverage.
The universal coverage law that we passed in 2006 that everyone benefits from right now. One in three people have some form of some form of subsidy within their healthcare insurance per se. And MassHealth is also the largest program that's funded in state government as we speak, to the point of about almost half of the state's budget. So the commitment that we have to, that Massachusetts has and the legislature has to equity is pretty profound. And throughout the years that I was in the legislature, we worked on initiatives to get to equity, and it had to do with care, with quality and care, and also an oversight within the system. But throughout all of this, there had always been a sense that we needed to place more attention in particular places, like cultural competency in the medical environments, because if you look at the statistics and the demographics of professionals, they don't necessarily reflect populations that are served. And at the same time, we've tried, the legislature has taken, the House and the Senate specifically took definitive measures to address scope of practice issues that allows for nurse practitioners to do other things that would allow for docs to practice at the top of their license while at the same time seeing more people. But at the same time, we do know that outcomes need to be improved and that there should be more of an emphasis placed on what the workforce looks like and also what culturally and linguistic appropriate services are available in healthcare and what I'll call multicultural healthcare.
I'm going to have to stop us there, but this is just a pause in a conversation that we want to continue with both of you and with the Health Equity Compact. So I just have to stop us there for today. Jeffrey Sanchez is a co-founder of the Health Equity Compact, faculty at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And Bud Williams is a Massachusetts state representative with the 11th Hampton District. I appreciate both of you being here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Tatiana. Thank you, Radio Boston.
All right. I want you to close your eyes because I'm going to read you something. I stood in Winter Street looking down into a soaring blaze, for everything from Kingston to Summer was burning. Trinity Church was beginning to smoke, and all the great granite blocks of stones were melting like ice in the awful heat. The fire went along behind Washington Street, leaping from one tall roof to another, but did not break through till it reached Franklin Street. Then, great fear was felt that it would sweep up Bromfield to the West End. Water had no effect, and they began to blow up buildings to stop the flames. Louisa May Alcott, in a letter to her sister, Anna Alcott Pratt, the date, November 10th, 1872, she is writing about the Great Boston Fire of 1872. And if you're sitting there thinking, what fire? You are not alone. But an exhibit about to open at Boston Athenaeum will show more of this hidden history. Here to tell us more about this fire, Anthony Sammarco. He is a Boston historian and author of the book Inferno, The Great Boston Fire of 1872. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you for having me.
So you've studied the fire, you've written about the fire. What do you think of? What comes to mind for you when you hear Louisa May Alcott's description about that night?
Well, her description is very apt. It's also the fact of the great inferno. It was something that was cataclysmic and in some instances would burn buildings one after the other. But it seems in some ways that she was one of many who would actually record their reminiscences of the fire in the next day or two. It was something that really did destroy 65 acres of downtown Boston. And it did seem as in some ways that water could not quell the fire. And it was in many ways something that would actually change late 19th century Boston. And when I think of the fire in some instances, it's part of the evolution of the history of the city. But in this instance, the book itself in photographic format chronicles the things that we actually have seen.
I want to go back to that night. Where specifically did it start and how?
Well, it started in the Kloos building. This was owned by a man named Seaman Kloos, a German immigrant. It was at the corner of Summer and Kingston Street in what we basically know today as the downtown business district. In that instance, it was a building that actually had three different companies that leased space. But it was thought that a spark would ignite a bale of cotton that would then ignite in some ways the entire building, and it went up an elevator shaft all the way to the mansard roof. In that instance, Boston also had an epizoic, and of course the horses that would have pulled the fire engines.
I'm going to stop you. Define what an epizoic is.
Well, an epizoic is an equine flu. It would affect horses, and it had been actually, one thinks, of course, that it had come from Canada, but during that period of late October and November of 1872, horses would have pulled fire engines, and of course these were 2-ton engines, and many of the men who would actually pull them were winded by the time they got there.
Because the horses literally couldn't pull them.
Of course, they were actually, you know, laying on the ground because they were quite ill. I think in some ways it was also water pressure was too low, and the fire plugs, which today we would call a fire hydrant, would not have enough pressure. And these buildings were 4 and 5 stories in height. These were things in some instances that actually made this a calamity of errors.
Okay, I'm going to bring a second voice in just a second. I can hear the listeners out there. You have as many questions as I do. Wait a minute. How did this happen? And how could so much have been damaged? And how do we not? Trust me, we will get to all of it. But we're laying this out a little bit by a little. How much damage was done, Anthony?
Well, it was 65 acres. It went from Washington Street, bound by Milk Street and Summer Street, all the way to the waterfront. And it was said that it was over 770 buildings.
So what percentage of Boston, roughly? Was that like half of Boston at the time? Commercial Boston? Is like most of commercial Boston at the time? Give us a sense of that.
Well, Boston was still basically only seeing the infilling of the South End and the Back Bay taking place. But this was primarily the entire area of downtown Boston.
So it took out downtown Boston.
Exactly, from the department stores at Washington Street all the way to what is basically today South Station.
All right, so now I'm going to bring in a second voice. Christina Michelon is the Associate Curator of Special Collections at the Boston Athenaeum. She curated the new exhibit, Revisiting the Ruins, The Great Boston Fire of 1872. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So you're not originally from Boston. You're from Chicago, which had its own fire, kind of the Great Chicago Fire. That one I feel like we all know about, right? So did you know about the Great Boston Fire before coming here?
I did not. And as you mentioned, the Great Chicago Fire is almost ubiquitous, not just to Chicagoans, but nationally, internationally. And when I started my role at the Boston Athenaeum, I learned about the Great Boston Fire and saw these incredible photographs, incredible reports on this event, and wondered why I didn't know about it. And I thought it was just me. Spoke to others from this region who didn't know about this event and just thought, you know, these images, the story is too incredible not to tell. And so we have to do an exhibition.
So I'm not sure which of you to ask this question, but why don't we know? Okay, so let's backtrack. The Great Boston Fire happens a year after the Great Chicago Fire. And there's a bunch of irony packed into there that we'll get to in a minute. But how is it possible that one fire that happens a year before wipes out Chicago, right? We all know about it. And another fire, which wipes out all of downtown Boston a year later, we don't know about it.
Yeah, my working theory is that Chicago really benefited from kind of this moment, this usable past, if you will, to kind of chart a new history for the city. It's a younger city in a way. It used the fire to kind of tell this Phoenix rising from the ashes story. I think for Boston, there is so much history regarding the Revolutionary War, regarding all of these other sites that were seen as historic in the city, that's kind of the history that gets told more often. I think the rebuilding happened so quickly in Boston that people who are really interested in sort of urban development, urban planning, and the city know the story. But, you know, there are objects in the show that talk about one building in particular that was a factory that burnt down in 1872, but it's described as Benjamin Franklin's birthplace, which it hadn't been. That building burnt down many years before the Boston Fire, actually. But that's the narrative that is often told. And so we miss this Boston Fire story.
Anthony, pick it up from there.
Well, it's a very interesting interpretation. But I teach a course at Boston University Metropolitan College on the history of Boston. And one of the aspects is the topographical changes in Boston, the infilling of the Back Bay and the South End. Immigration to Boston, topographical changes. It's also the fact that we see calamities such as this fire. A lot of my students have no comprehension that they're even taking a walking tour in the Back Bay, which was actually built on filled land. But the whole concept is, I think the fire is something that has eluded many, many people. And I mean, I knew about it as a child. I was fascinated with it. My grandfather would point out basically some of the buildings that were rebuilt right after the fire itself. And I would always wonder sometimes, why was it that none of my friends knew about this? Granted, I loved history. But it is something I think that's a very important aspect, not only to chronicle in a book format, but also in that aspect to actually provide an exhibition for the general public to learn not only about the history of Boston, but about this one calamity that, you know, basically affected hundreds of thousands of people.
So we're talking about the Great Boston Fire, which happened in 1872. If I understand it, then, if I'm going to sort of get this summary right, Christina, and I'm going to be overly crass on purpose, Chicago needed this piece of history.
Yeah.
Boston didn't.
I think so.
And there was a speed of rebuild for Boston that made it more of a blip than it was for Chicago.
That's right. And another important distinction that historians often make is Chicago, unfortunately, there was a much higher number of casualties. A lot of residential neighborhoods were impacted. In Boston, it's often spoken about in financial terms. So it was a much more expensive calamity. But thankfully, the loss of life was much lower.
Anthony Sammarco, it was $80 million in 1872 dollars. Kind of blows my mind.
It's incredible. It's $1.4 billion in today's cash. And I think one realizes in some instances, some people were wiped out. Many of the insurance companies would actually be unable to pay the claims simply for the fact there were so many. But it was also the fact that the city of Boston made a concerted effort to rebuild the burnt district, as it was called.
It was literally called that, like in capital letters.
Yes.
After it burned down, that was called the burnt district.
Exactly. And, you know, for 6 months, they actually had members of the various police and cadets actually protecting the burnt area. It was something that was really quite devastating, but it was also in some instances something that people realized in some ways. This was the major part of the city for the economic aspects. And by rebuilding quickly, it seems incredible that Boston within a decade was on firm footing.
One of the in Christina and some of the artifacts pictures that I saw also in your book, Anthony, there are descriptions of people scrambling to their businesses that night and into the next day, trying to get goods out. Shreve Crump and Lowe lost their building not by the fire, but by an explosion that happened. People are trying to get their ledgers out. They're trying to get their supplies out. I mean, this was on a practical basis for individual proprietors, et cetera. Devastating. So while we talk about 10 years later, we've recovered, how do individuals recover from something like that? Christina?
That's a great question. I think the exhibition really does linger on this moment between the event itself, the fire, the blaze, and this rebuilding, and really focuses on how people are reckoning with this destruction, how they're romanticizing it or sensationalizing it or just kind of sitting with it.
Yeah, you've got like music and photo. Talk some about that.
That's right. So I think really at the heart of the show are a number of incredible photographs by James Wallace Black, a Boston photographer, and they are technical feats for the time that he made them in. They're mammoth-sized pictures. He made an incredible panorama that really just aims to show the magnitude of this destruction. But we're also seeing these images being translated into print and appearing in newspapers, because at this time you couldn't print photographs in the newspaper. And so we're seeing the ways that people engaged with this material as newsworthy items that was covered internationally. We're seeing it published in British newspapers as well. We also have some incredible paintings, a sculpture, which I think will be a surprise for some folks. And one of the other exciting components is this opportunity to view stereographs, which are a kind of 19th century photograph. It's two identical images side by side that when looked at through a stereoscope, merges the images and they become 3D.
Meaning that you can see the burnt district, and the what was burnt, basically,
exactly.
Overlaid.
Exactly. It's kind of like a ViewMaster, if you all remember those. So you have that 3D experience. And these were a really common kind of entertainment in the 19th century. And so we installed a great number of those. These were produced in huge numbers. And so we have about 36 of them in the exhibition. And we have custom-made stereoscopes that people can use to look at these images as they would have been looked at the time.
So Anthony Sammarco, you know, this quote from Louisa May Alcott, all the great granite blocks of stone were melting like ice in the awful heat, kind of blew my mind. Who knew granite would do that, right, with fire? So what changed afterward in terms of how we built, how we fought fires, et cetera?
Well, after the fire, the city of Boston took a concerted effort to look at the burnt district and learn from it. Immediately, they appointed a city architect for the city of Boston, and George Clough would actually oversee the rebuilding, not just of the burnt district, but of all buildings in the city. So whether they were schools, municipal buildings, fire stations, police stations, they had to actually have code. They not only had to have fire and party walls, they could no longer use a wood trussed mansard roof, which basically had spread the fire tremendously and very quickly. But it was also the fact that rebuilding in downtown Boston would only be by brick or stone, limestone, marble, granite. But the granite was so intensely affected by the fire that it imploded. It simply broke, or just, as Louisa May Alcott said, it melted. But what it did was basically just implode into small pieces. And I think one of the things is that people realized in some instances the intensity of the fire, not only of the heat, but that it could be seen as far as the Blue Hills in Milton, showed the magnitude of this fire. I mean, 65 acres was burning, and many people really perceived that the entire city was going to be destroyed. And it was something in some ways that was not just cataclysmic, but it was something in some ways that was eventually spoken about by ministers and priests in the city of Boston in the ensuing Sundays, that one could learn from the lessons of greed and avarice as well as inept architectural details.
And Christina Michelon, in our last 30 seconds, the other coda is that the fire chief had gone to Chicago and tried to learn from Chicago before the Boston fire happened, And what he came back with had fallen on deaf ears.
That's right. That's right. So Chief Damrell did go to Chicago after the dust had settled, so to speak, and wanted to learn from their mistakes, bring some reforms back to Boston. And a lot of them just weren't acted upon. And so Damrell's really looked at as kind of this advocate for fire safety from the time. And we're grateful to him because we have so many improvements to point to now.
All right. Christina Michelon is the Associate Curator of Special Collections at the Boston Athenaeum. She curated the new exhibit, Revisiting the Ruins, the Great Boston Fire of 1872, which opens April 7th. Anthony Simarco is a Boston historian and author of the book Inferno, the Great Boston Fire of 1872. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listen, another invitation. Join us tomorrow, Thursday, at WBUR City Space for the popular Curated Cuisine series featuring Radio Boston's Brewed in Mass. It's a beer festival with six breweries doing tastings in the City Space lobby. That's like Jack's Abbey, Sam Adams, Lamplighter, and others. We'll discuss the craft beer industry here in the Bay State, talk things like beer culture. Doors open at 5:30. The event starts at 6:30. I'll be hosting. You can find in-person or virtual tickets at wbur.org/events. Might be a good one to come in person for. Tap in with us tomorrow night at City Space. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. On behalf of the whole team, thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.